So thank you very much, Roger, and I'd like to thank Dr. Mercola and Goldstein for the wonderful opportunity and invitation to provide one of the keynote addresses for this meeting. It was actually about 43 years ago that I first stepped foot on this campus when I was an undergraduate at UC San Diego, so it's a great homecoming for me. So my talk today is going to be about the human neural stem cells from discovery to clinic, and it's probably a talk that you're, you know, that you might start seeing more and more of as stem cells translate into clinical applications. Since we are a publicly traded company, I'm required to show this forward-looking statement. But I would like to spend the rest of my talk talking very briefly about the biology of the human neural stem cells. And since this work is published, I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights and really delve into the rigorous preclinical characterizations we've done in order to translate these cells into clinical trials. And the four trials that I'll talk briefly upon, highlighting some key preclinical observations that have led to the clinical trial and some of the clinical trial data we're seeing in a couple of these indications. And so this lists the four clinical trials that we've initiated or completed. And if I have time at the end, I'll talk about our newest endeavor due to a CIRM Disease Team Award in Alzheimer's disease. So just to give you, for those of you who are now entering the space and thinking about clinical translation, it is a long road in stem cell to get from discovery to clinic. So this gives you an overview of the timeline. The company was founded by three of the stem cell gurus, Rusty Gage here at the Salk, Irv Weissman at Stanford, and David Anderson. And we had operational labs in 98. We discovered, identified and purified the human neural stem cell in 99. It was published in 2000. And since that time, we've marched along a pathway of mainly in vivo characterization. And as you can see, in the first several years, there wasn't a lot of clinical trial activity. But as we have established more and more biology of the cells, as well as the safety profile, we've accelerated the number of trials that we have begun in these later years. So this gives you the timeline, and so it's taken us about 13 years to where we are today. So just briefly, we identified and purified these cells from brain tissue of 16 to 20 gestational weeks using monoclonal antibodies and high-speed cell sorting. The purification of these cells has led to reproducible expansion into cell banks using a defined serum-free media. And you can see that we can reproducibly generate cell banks by the purification and this defined media process, which is very important for the eventual manufacturing of the cells for clinical trials. Moreover, we've shown at the single cell level that a single cell can self-renew and form and grow as these balls of cells called neurospheres, and that when you differentiate these cells, a single cell gives rise to the self-renewing clone of cells, and they can differentiate into neurons and astrocytes in vitro and form oligodendrocytes in vivo. So that was our rigorous definition of a human neural stem cell. And because we wanted to use these cells in cell-based therapies, it was really important to characterize what these cells could do in the context of the CNS. So we developed an in vivo transplant paradigm based in the immunodeficient mouse models, and where we looked at a single transplant of these cells into the lateral ventricles. And what you're looking at here is a sagittal section of a mouse brain 47 weeks after transplant. And all of the brown staining you're seeing are the human cells that have engrafted and migrated globally throughout the brain. Upon more detailed examination, we see these cells slowly proliferate within the endogenous neurogenic niche in the subventricular area or in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. They use one of the pathways to migrate out of the subventricular area called the rostral migrating stream, which is present in the developing mouse brain. And they land in the olfactory bulb, and there they differentiate in a site-specific manner into one of the cell types as a granular neuron. We've also have other work, which I'll show later, that the cells differentiate into myelin-producing oligodendrocytes in the white matter areas. So this data set in vivo, we've transplanted over 3,000 to 4,000 mice to date in various animal models and show the cells engraft and survive long term. There's global migration within either the brain or the spinal cord. And they mature in a site-specific manner dictated by the host microenvironment. And so the question we faced after we knew what these cells could possibly do is, what disease target should we first enter into clinical trials? Because these would be the first in man of a human neural stem cell that's expanded and banked. And there would be regulatory concerns, so on the safety and the equipoise, the risk-reward. Because once you transplant the cells, there's no way to remove them. So we decided upon our first in-man target was in a rare and fatal lysosomal storage disease called neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, or Batten's disease is the more common. We focused on the infantile and late infantile form because it's a soluble enzyme that is defective in these diseases. And we knew that these human neural stem cells naturally produced and secreted these lysosomal enzyme. And because we had global distribution of the cells throughout the brain, we figured that these cells could serve as enzyme delivery vehicles throughout the brain. Moreover, there was an exquisite transgenic knockout mouse model called the PPT1 knockout, in which recapitulated many of the aspects of the human disease. And so when we looked at the brains of these animals, if you look in the hippocampal area, you can quantitate the number of cells in the various CA regions of the hippocampus. And we see that in this the brain of these mice, there were only 8% of the CA1 hippocampal neurons remaining. So we asked, what would be the effect on the preservation of these host neurons after transplanting the human neural stem cells? And in a series of studies we performed, we showed that a single transplant of human neural stem cells could protect these host cells. Up to 60% of the host cells can be protected in the CA1 region of the hippocampus, and up to 97% in the cortical regions of this animal model. So this was some of the data that led to our phase one study at OHSU with Bob Steiner and Nate Selden, in which 6 children with infantile or late infantile forms of the disease were transplanted with up to 1 billion human neural stem cells. Now, because these were the first-in-man studies, we had to start with the most severely impacted children that had significant brain atrophy. So about a year after the study, one of the children succumbed to the disease course, and during the long-term follow-up, we two additional children died. And we had the opportunity to do a post-mortem brain-only autopsy, in which we were able to show not only the presence of the human cells, but also their migration deep within the brain structure. And this this analysis was done up to 2.5 years post-transplant, 1.5 years after stopping immunosuppression. So during that 1.5 years after you stop immunosuppression, these cells, in a very degenerated and hostile environment, can still survive and had migrated. So some of the data we saw in the preclinical animal models, such as global migration and protection of host hippocampal and cortical neurons, and engraftment in the severely degenerated brain, we saw engraftment, migration, and long-term survival of these cells in our clinical studies. We also showed that the procedure into these very medically fragile patients were tolerated and that there were no safety concerns attributable to the transplant of up to 1 billion cells. So this really set the stage for further clinical studies. 3 of the patients are now greater than 5 years post-transplants, and they're not having any signs of any deleterious effects of the transplant of the cells. So using that, the safety data that was accumulating in these patients and additional preclinical data, we embarked upon another study for a myelin disorder. And you know that the oligodendrocytes in the CNS produce the myelin that wraps the host axon for proper nerve conductivity. And we knew from our preclinical studies in animals that our human neural stem cells were capable of differentiating to oligodendrocytes, which
produce multiple processes that were able to wrap the host axon with the myelin. These studies were done in an immunodeficient shiver mouse, which lacks the ability to make myelin. And you can see in these two panels the robust myelin production, here shown in brown, here shown in green. And then with Rusty Gage, we were able to show that the human myelin, and she's the mouse axons, and in collaboration with Eileen Anderson's lab by ImmunoEM, we showed that these myelin wraps produce 16 to 20 major dense line, which is a normal wrapping for axons. We went on to show with Stephen Back and Larry Sherman at OHSU that you can use ex vivo MRI imaging to detect new myelin in transplanted mouse brain. So the top panel here shows the human myelin by MRI imaging. And this was confirmed by staining the mouse brain with human with myelin basic protein. And they went on to show that the myelin that was produced is functional by doing compound action recording on the axons in the corpus callosum, and showed that there was increased mean amplitudes in all of the animals that received human neural stem cell transplant compared to either animals that received vehicle controls or mesenchymal stromal cells. And so this told us that our cells were capable of myelinating host axon, and you can detect these changes using MRI imaging. So we embarked upon our next clinical study in a disease called Politzius-Mertzbacher. It's a fatal leukodystrophy due to mutations in the proteolipid protein, which is a major CNS myelin protein. These children have diffusely abnormal and underdeveloped white matter, and the strategy was to transplant up to 3 million cells into the major white matter area, the centrum seminal valley, by doing transplants into two sites bilaterally. So the study was done at UCSF with David Roach in neonatology and Nalin Gupta in neurosurgery. There were this is an X-linked disease, and we had to transplant the most severe form, which is the conatal form, in which the children have signs and symptoms of the disease before 6 months of age. We enrolled four children in this study. This table shows you some of the characteristics of the subjects, as young as 14 months and as old as 66 months. And what you'll note is that none of the children have the ability to self-feed, or those in the older children, they were not able to walk, and they had very little language skills. As I mentioned, you can use MRI imaging to detect the myelin, and here you're looking at the T2-weighted MRI image, and the myelin appears as these very dense, hyper-intense structures here, which is absent in PMD. And you can use diffusion tensor imaging that'll measure the motion of water molecules that are trapped by myelin. So you can imagine that in a structure where it's tightly wrapped, there is going to be less diffusion of the water molecule. So this technique allows you, or this imaging technique allows you to examine changes in white matter structure and more highly oriented, organized myelinated axons will have a higher fractional anisotropy, or FA. So we compared transplant regions versus control region in all of the subjects. We reported the data at 1 year at the conclusion of the phase one study, and we were able to show that there were changes in white matter in all of the subjects where you see the increasing fractional anisotropy in the children who receive the transplants. And the arrow indicates the one-year time point. We just recently completed the analysis of the patients that had reached the two-year time point, and you see that the changes that we saw at 1 year were sustained and actually increased between 1 and 2 years. And so this change in fractional anisotropy is progressive and stable. And this is the increase is more obvious compared to the controls in the older children. In one subject, the first subject, he's now reached the three-year time point, and it's very dramatic to see the increase in this child's FA. So we see a continuing increase in the transplant regions at 2 to 3 years post-transplant. So if you look at the neurological exams in these children, subject one remained stable, and this was one of the younger children. But what was significant is he had reduced a nightly use of continuous positive air pressure at 12 months and continues to be off the CPAP. Subject two developed improved truncal support. So if you look at these children before the transplant, they were not able to sit up or hold up their heads, and they have improved truncal support. And this child developed the ability to take steps with assistance, began speaking audible single words, and the ability to follow two-step commands. Subject three, the youngest child, developed upper extremity anti-gravity strength, started taking solid foods orally. This child had a feeding tube before transplant and also had reduced nightly CPAP. The fourth subject developed improved truncal support and progressed from the use of a walker to with significant support at baseline to walking with minimal assistance. And he developed both the ability to self-feed and follow two-step commands. So these are clinical signs that that are unexpected for this very severely impacted patient population. So in our preclinical studies, we showed that you can detect myelin changes by MRI imaging, and that when we did histological analysis, we see the formation of human oligodendrocytes that produce functional myelin. In our clinical studies, we show MRI evidence of donor-derived myelin production. And our two-year results, which we just reported out, support the phase one or the one-year observations. And there's more pronounced MRI evidence of myelin, and the clinical gains that were observed at 1 year are also maintained. And the next study is in planning. So the next area, so in traumatic spinal cord injury, one of the sequela of the traumatic contusion is demyelination and axonal loss. And so the studies from the PMD supported, you know, looking at whether we would get remyelination in spinal cord injured animals. And we had initiated many years previously a collaboration with Eileen Anderson and Brian Cummings at UC Irvine, who developed models to look at the effects of human neural stem cell transplants in the injured spinal cord immediately after injury, 9 days in the subacute period, and 30 days after injury in more of a chronic period. And what she showed was that transplant of these cells could restore lost motor function in the open field. In the open field BBB test, and that this restoration of motor function required the presence of the integrated human cells, because when she treated these animals with diphtheria toxin, which selectively ablates the human cells, you lost that restored motor function. She went on to show that this restoration of motor function also occurred in chronic spinal cord injured animals, and this data is all published. She performed an analysis of the fate of the human cells and shown that they engraft in the chronic injured animals and that they remyelinate and form synaptic formation. So here you're looking at immuno-EM analysis where the human cells are stained with the human-specific antibody here and here, and they're capable of myelinating host axons, and they form a synaptic cleft between the mouse and human cells. So we also know from her quantitative analysis that the number of human cells increase over time, as well as migrate above and below the injury level, which is important when you think about what you would do in the clinical setting. And as I mentioned, these cells are capable of differentiating into the three neural cell types. So based on this and other data, we initiated a phase 1-2 study in spinal cord injured patients in Switzerland under Dr. Armin Kurt at the Balgris Hospital, authorized by the Swiss Regulatory Authority. We are now actually authorized to begin studies in Canada and the U.S. This study was going to enroll 12 chronic stage patients with thoracic injuries spanning the T2 to T11 injury levels. And we, the unique thing about this trial design and reason we went to Switzerland is we can enroll subjects who are both complete injured, ASIA A, as well as incomplete Bs and Cs within the context of one trial. We would we're transplanting 20 million cells total, both above and below the injury level. And after the dosing of the first three ASIA A patients, we had a data safety monitoring committee who reviewed the data and allowed us to proceed to dosing the incomplete injured ASIA B patients. The transplants were performed using preoperative MRI as well as intraoperative ultrasound to guide the neurosurgeon, and the transplants were done by handheld syringe by the neurosurgeon. We were not using a device. We reported out interim data for the 12-month safety profile on the three ASIA A patients to show that, as we had seen in the clinical trials into the brain, the there was a very favorable safety profile and no product-related adverse events. And both the surgery and immunosuppression were well tolerated in these patients. There was no evidence of any safety concerns, such as emerging increased pain or allodynia or sensitivity to heat. And the observed changes in light touch sensation also support the safety profile. Since this time, we've enrolled three additional patients, both ASIA A and ASIA B. And what I will walk you through is just a couple of the tests that we have performed to show the function of these in these patients. So this slide represents the numerous, some of the tests that are performed on these patients, where we test sensory function at each dermatome level, which are the different segments of the spinal cord. There are some that are subjective tests, such as light touch and pin prick, and there are more objective measures, such as the dermatomal somatosensory evoked potentials or the cutaneous heat evoked potentials. So in the subject three, which had a very high thoracic injury level, at, injury at T3, before transplant, the subject had no sensory or motor function below the injury level. This is a 45-year-old male who suffered a bike accident. And 6 months as well as 1 year after transplant, he reported changes in the light touch sensation. And these multi-segmental gains were correlated with quantitative tests, such as the electrical perception test, where before transplant, you stimulate an electrical stimulus at different dermatomes, and he's not reporting any sensation. And in post-transplant, you see that he's starting to have some sense of an electrical stimulus. Those are subjective measures. We did the somatosensory evoked potential, which essentially measures signals in the brain after stimulation below the injury level. So this person had a T3 injury, as I mentioned. So testing at the thoracic, the T7 level, which is below his injury, where he showed no function below that T3, you see he has no amplitudes or latencies. When you stimulate below, you're not detecting any signal above in the brain. And 6 months after transplant, this patient is now starting to show amplitudes and latencies when he is stimulated in both the SSEP as well as the CHEP. These changes persisted at 12 months, and he has converted to what is considered an ASIA B. So he converted from a complete injured subject with no sensory or motor function to Asia B with some sensory function below the injury. So just briefly, our human cells were able to restore motor locomotor function in subacute and chronic spinal cord injured animals that required the presence of human cells to maintain this motor function. These human cells differentiated into myelin-producing oligodendrocytes as well as synapse-forming neurons. And in our clinical studies, which we have not yet published on because the study isn't complete, we have shown interim data which shows multi-segmental sensory gains in light touch, electrical, and thermal stimulation. And as I mentioned, the study is ongoing and now open to enrollment in U.S. and Canada. So the last area in which we've initiated a clinical study is age-related macular degeneration. It's the leading cause of blindness and a loss of vision in patients over 55. And it's the loss of light-sensing neurons in the central part of the eye. And so this is essentially what a patient would see when they lose their central vision. And what we've shown in the two publications that I list here are that the neural stem cells prevent or slow the loss of vision in a well-accepted animal model for retinal degeneration, the Royal College of Surgeon rats. And the mechanism of action, we believe, is the neuroprotection of photoreceptors through probably multiple mechanisms. This part of the slide shows you what happens in the RCS rat over time. These are the photoreceptor layers, and over time you can see that this photoreceptor layer disappears so that at P90 there are very few photoreceptors left. And when we transplant the human neural stem cells here into the subretinal space, you're able to preserve the photoreceptors, and this is at P90, and at P240 days post-transplant, you see that compared to the non-transplanted animals, you preserve these photoreceptors. So we showed that the transplants have led to the preservation of visual acuity in this OKR test, compared to the animals who received media alone. And this is due to the preservation of the cone photoreceptors, which are lost in the non-treated animals. With our collaborators, Nicholas Cuenca, we went on to show that that what we see in the histological analysis of the untreated animals is that there is this debris zone that builds up, which are the shed photoreceptor outer segments. And that debris zone is absent in the animals that receive, or in the areas of the transplanted cells. And when he went on to show that using immuno-EM, what he's seeing is that the RPE layer normally provides the phagocytic function of the shed outer segments, whereas in these animals that have received the human neural stem cells, these human neural stem cells are actually phagocytosing the shed photoreceptor outer segments, shown here and in higher magnification here. He also noted that the inner retinal layers were also more robust. And when you look at the function and how the photoreceptors transmit signals, there is an interaction between the photoreceptor cells and horizontal and bipolar cells, and that they form this triad of cells in the inner retinas. And when he went on to look by immuno-EM, he sees that in the animals that received a transplant, you're maintaining these connections between the bipolar and horizontal cells, and you see these very prominent synaptic ribbons. And this particular area is one of those triads where the confluence of these three elements come together, and these are maintained in the animals that receive the transplant. And that's in contrast to the animals, or in contrast to the untreated regions where you see very few rods or cones, and that the synaptic ribbons that you observed are free-floating and that are not associated with any structures. So based on this data, we initiated a study in dry age-related macular degeneration, so the geographic atrophy form. The trial is currently enrolling. We've dosed six subjects to date. There are two cohorts, those who receive a dose of 200,000 cells and who have very significant visual impairment, less than 2,400. And that cohort will be, four will receive a low dose and four will receive a high dose of 1,000,000 cells. And then the second cohort, there will enroll 8 subjects with better visual acuity of 2,200 to 2,200, and they will receive a high dose of the cells. So stay tuned for those results. So the last subject I'll touch on is for Alzheimer's disease. As you know, this is a major emerging healthcare issue worldwide. It's a progressive neurodegenerative condition. And the failure of drugs in phase 3 trials recently highlights the need for looking at new treatment options. So the hallmarks of the disease are the amyloid plaques, neurofibrillary tangles that lead to synaptic dysfunction and loss and eventual neuronal loss. We had done some studies early on with George Carlson at the McLaughlin Research Institute where we showed that transplant of human neural stem cells into a very heavily plaque-laden brain resulted in the survival global migration of the cells, even directly adjacent to a plaques, indicating that these plaques were not toxic to the transplanted human neural stem cells. So the combination of global migration, neuronal differentiation and synapse formation, neuroprotection, and synapse preservation in the other animal models that we saw, and as well as the engraftment and survival of these cells in heavily plaque-laden brain, led us to think that these cells might be useful in protecting the neurons in the hippocampal area of Alzheimer's patients. So we were awarded a CIRM Disease Team Award in collaboration with Frank LaFerla and Matthew Burton-Jones at UC Irvine. And just briefly, the preliminary data shows that transplanting these cells into Alzheimer's relevant animal models improves learning and memory. And this example is showing in the aged triple transgenic mice, which have two of the Alzheimer's pathology, the A-beta and the tau, that these animals show, in the Morris water maze test, show decreased latencies and increased platform crosses in those that receive the transplant compared to controls. And what they examine histologically is that there is an increase in GAP43 expression, which is one of the indicators of increased axonal sprouting and synaptic connectivity. So we're in the process of repeating these studies with clinical cell lots in the hopes of transitioning these to clinical study in the future. So in summary and progress to date, we've shown the safety and feasibility and tolerability of transplants into three components of the CNS, the brain, the spinal cord, and now the eye with the studies pending. The dose range in these studies have ranged from 20 million cells to 1 billion. We see cell survival and migration even after immunosuppression is stopped. So it indicates that we may not have to keep patients on lifelong immunosuppression. And there's clinical proof of concept of evidence of a donor-derived myelin and gains in neurological function from our PMD study, and positive segmental sensory function gains in our spinal cord injured patients in the interim data that we've analyzed to date. So the clinical data is recapitulating some of the results that we've seen in animals. And so I think the rigorous preclinical and in vivo analysis we've done on these cells have really helped us translate these studies into clinical testing. And I hope that the future will bring more enticing data in this area. So I'd just like to acknowledge our founders and our collaborators. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Will. Time for a couple of questions. Laura, you're with...
Either one. I was curious as to how you balance the dose with the condition, and if you have an idea of how many cells just, you know, deteriorate in the toxic, the pathological environment versus how many are sort of actively targeted by the immune system.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So, you know, since I had a lot of experience with the hematopoietic stem cell prior to the working on the human neural stem cell, we were able to predict the dose in which we would see rapid engraftment in the animal models based on the body weight. In the CNS, it was a little different because you're not dealing with the whole body. You're dealing actually with, you know, one target organ. And so we did allometric scaling between the mouse and human based on brain volume. Same with the spinal cord.
Any others? Larry Goldstein, down.
So the myelination data are amazing. I mean, that's very cool. The question is, it's a small number of patients, and how much do you know about just the endogenous variability in the rates of myelination, both in a non-clinical and a clinical population?
Right. So there are studies that have been done looking at myelin in various areas of normal children that have developed. So in the younger patients, you see changes in areas of increasing fractional anisotropy. And nobody has done a longitudinal study in the PMD patients, but these children never get better, and they actually, you know, continue to regress as they get older. So the increase in FA that we're seeing and the clinical gains are unexpected from, you know, what the clinicians who follow these patients over time. But you're right, you know, and that's what we're currently trying to design is the next clinical study. To do more of a controlled analysis.
Interesting. We'll find out later when Luke Larson comes up as well, his new paper in Nature, and there's a News and Views on it called An Old Drug Plays a New Trick, in which the discussion we had at dinner last night about myelination and the benztropine coming back again, it was sort of rather interesting, but we'll hear more from you later on that. Because we were slightly late, I think,
yes,
unless you, we're going to, just a round of applause for Anne, thank you.